And so in Rumi's field, I join each of us, each one of you there, out beyond the ideas of right doing and wrong doing. We meet and we remember who we are. So let us join together in song, I Am Remembering. And so breathing in and releasing, we return to the open-eyed state, being with what is, as it is, and so it is. Thank you. Thank you, Mary, choir, the cats. Not so many if you only two cats today. That was really beautiful. That was really beautiful. So today we have speaking with us and joining with us Michael Esslin. Michael, as you know, has been here before several times. He is a board-certified chaplain, and he serves at the oncology as the oncology chaplain for Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. He speaks extensively to doctors, nurses, social workers, patient populations, and faith communities across the country. Michael weaves stories with insight, vulnerability, and humor to wrap around the larger questions of life, mortality, and meaning. He has also been an active educator and activist, addressing anti-LGBT bias for well over 25 years. He has two TED Talks and has been published widely in journals and periodicals. He will have four volumes of CDs available for purchase after the service, each including three of his talks. Volume four is brand new, so let's give a warm Ventura welcome to Michael Esslin.
It is always such a joy for me to return here. Thank you for the nice, warm welcome. According to the writer Dennis Holy, expecting life to treat you fairly because you're a good person is a little like expecting a bull not to attack you because you're vegetarian. Bulls can be counted on to do what bulls do, and life can be counted on to do what life does, namely throw us curveballs. Despite all of our best efforts to control it, no matter what we might believe about how prepared we are, no matter what we might believe about justice and fairness and who deserves what, no matter what we might believe or not about the existence of a supreme pitcher of life's curveballs, God, as it were, we all get them out of the blue, out of our control. Now, justice and fairness are bedrock American values. You can ask anybody here. And many of us are all about social justice, too, God knows. Although I sometimes marvel that we say that with a straight face, justice, as if we know what that means. Justice as defined by whom? Don't you suppose the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks believed in their heart of hearts that they were acting out of a deep sense of justice? The crazy irony to me is that many of us were taught from a very early age that life isn't fair. At the same time, we were also taught, wait your turn, don't cut in line, give somebody else a chance to play with the ball. I sometimes wonder if we internalize both messages so deeply that we spend the rest of our lives trying to disentangle this dance of opposites, knowing it isn't fair, and yet shooting for, aiming for some sense of justice and fairness, no matter how impossible to define or to realize. A few years back, I was listening to a podcast, an episode of This American Life, all about a professional theater director who staged a production of Hamlet in a maximum security men's prison, using the prisoners as actors. As I listened to the stories unfold, my heart just opened up to the astonishing beauty, to the healing, redemptive power of art on these wounded souls. Of course, I didn't know anything about the crimes for which they'd been convicted until much later in the hour. But by then it was too late. I'd already fallen in love. Once I did hear about those horrors, however, ideas about justice and fairness became far more murky. Here's the very intersection of where our idea of inherent worth and dignity meets justice and fairness. Now, it's a common chant to hear at any number of rallies or demonstrations for one just cause or another, no justice, no peace. Of course, I get it. More often than not, I applaud the message and the messenger. But what happens when that injustice hits closer to home, like, say, a diagnosis of cancer? How do we possibly come to peace when wrestling with an injustice like that? In my work as an oncology chaplain, I meet folks all over the belief spectrum. And from what I observe, everyone from the devoutly religious Christian to the cool cerebral atheist, at some point along the way, bumps into this wall that says, why me? This isn't fair. I'm a good person. I did everything right. I ate right. I exercised. I got mammograms every 6 months. What do you mean I have stage 4 breast cancer? But I'm only 42 years old. At the same moment, these folks might also espouse that other truism that would say, nobody said life's fair, right? There are also those on the other side who will proclaim from the outset, and often quite proudly, I have never asked why me. Why would I? I look around the world, I see suffering everywhere, I see little kids who get cancer. And so I say, why not me? The way I see it, that statement is its own attempt at a coping strategy, an attempt to construe some sense of justice and therefore a pathway to peace, because after all, it's random, it's impersonal, shit happens. Somebody had to get the cancer, maybe it was just my turn, maybe it was just my bad luck. But what I find is even those folks, at some point along the way, will bump into that wall that says, hey, but this is me. It's not fair, it's not right. Heidi, 32 years old, newly diagnosed with ovarian cancer, called the center, desperate for someone to talk to help her make sense of all of this. She used that expression several times. Heidi had grown up in a pretty strict Protestant tradition, but more recently had found some inspiration in some Buddhist readings she had done. Michael, I don't understand why this is happening to me. I'm a good person. I've never knowingly hurt anybody. I've been taught since I was a little girl to help others. I'm always the first to volunteer, and I've been praying so hard, and God won't answer me. I'm so angry. Why? She raises so many themes here. Not only this desire to make sense of it, but who or what is God? How does prayer work? What to do with this anger? But front and center is this theme of justice and fairness. Over my years of study and reading, I've come upon this perspective, this theory, that for any genuine transformation to take place, it must be preceded by a betrayal and a death. Betrayal, death, transformation. We might look to the Jesus story as an example that Jesus had to be betrayed, had to die for the whole centerpiece of Christian thought to take place, resurrection, transformation. This pattern exists in many of the world's great myths. Now, it needn't necessarily mean a physical death, but maybe the death of a belief, a political, an economic system, maybe the death of a relationship, maybe the death of a career path. Might be interesting to look back at your own life at moments of profound growth and see if such a moment was indeed preceded by something that could be seen as a betrayal and a death. With Heidi, as it is with so many cancer patients, her old understanding of what is true, how does God work, simply wasn't big enough to contain this new reality. It had to be betrayed and had to die for there to be any possibility of any new truth to be revealed to her, one that would be big enough to contain this new reality. When we teased apart her statements and what they really revealed about her beliefs, she had to acknowledge that she believed, if I'm a good person and do the right thing, I won't get sick and I'll never die. It's not so different, really, from a belief in Santa Claus. If I'm a good little girl, eat my vegetables and don't sass back, I'll get a shiny red bicycle for Christmas. In a way, she had to grieve the death of Santa at 32. Something for all of us to consider: can I be open enough, porous enough to allow in a new truth when the old one isn't big enough to contain this new reality? Angela came to the same spiritual crossroads, but from a very different path. She came from a path of New Age thought, a deep meditation practice, a belief in karma, another way of saying it's a just universe out there. Michael, when I was first diagnosed, I started meditating more religiously than ever, 5, 6, 7 times a day, hours at a time. And then my scans revealed that there was disease progression, and I felt so betrayed and angry. And I realized I hadn't been meditating for the right reason at all. Not for the peace it could give me in that moment. I was meditating because I thought it might cure me. Both Heidi and Angela were attached to a very specific outcome, namely cure. It was the only thing that would do. It would have to be the most human of all urges. Who doesn't want to be cured of cancer? But what if it's just not in the cards? What if the most I can hope for is more time living with chronic illness? Or what if, God forbid, this disease does mean the imminent end of my physical body? Am I not entitled to peace? Am I not entitled to some experience of healing that may not include cure? How do I possibly come to peace when dealing with an injustice like that? Abby, 48 years old, an artist, a teacher, she lost the love of her life, her husband Paul, after 20-some years of marriage, to pancreatic cancer. Abby and Paul never had children. They filled their lives with their love of each other, their dogs, their work, and their beloved Christian Science faith community. It was the centerpiece of their world. When Paul was first diagnosed and given a poor prognosis, even with medical intervention, despite the tenets of their faith and the admonitions from their faith community, they decided to go for it. Life was too precious not to give Paul this shot. He did last for 2 grueling years on treatment, but the disease did take his life. And their choice to use medical intervention ended up costing them their faith community. It was a devastating blow for both of them. He's been gone a few years now, and Abby still struggles so deeply with this idea of justice and fairness. I don't understand, Michael. I can't accept this. Why Paul? He was such a good man. Why me? Why us? It doesn't make any sense. And I don't even believe in that stuff anymore, that God rewards good and punishes evil, that everything happens for a reason. There's betrayal and death. Her grief is so deep, so profound, so complete that she finds herself without any faith at all to stand upon. No hope, no hope for a future, no desire even for more life. And yet she confides, "I would never take my own life." "Why not?" I asked. "I couldn't do that to my parents. I love them too much. And my dogs, they need me. And if there is life on the other side, I want to spend it with Paul. And what if doing that meant I couldn't be with him?" Old beliefs die hard. And so we concluded that she still did have faith in love. It was enough to keep her here, if only by a thread. So we started there, just perhaps laying the foundation for transformation. Standing on the other side of all these stories, struggling to claim justice, was Lyle. Lyle's in his mid-70s. He's a crusty fellow with this kind of good old boy southern drawl and demeanor about him. He's lived most of his life as a loner, an outsider, has spent a number of pretty turbulent years there. He does love to ride his motorcycle, though. That's the place he finds his peace. He also finds himself with a diagnosis of stage 4 lung cancer, living in an assisted living facility where he shares that the subject of Judgment Day, who gets into heaven and who doesn't, is a constant source of conversation. Around the elevator, in the community room, which he calls God's little waiting room. Now, Lyle would never identify as religious by any stretch, but his Southern Baptist roots do run pretty deep. And the core of his spiritual distress, "Michael, what if I don't get into heaven? In other words, what if there is justice and I'm standing on the wrong side of it?" I asked Lyle if he was God, would he condemn himself to hell? And he thought for a moment, said, "You know, Michael, no, I would not. I would say, Lyle, you should have gone to church more. You should have kept my day holy. But no, you can go to heaven. Go on now." I was glad to hear it. I asked him if he thought perhaps riding his Harley up PCH on a gorgeous Sunday morning with the sun and wind in his face, feeling grateful to be alive, might be its own kind of prayer. Might it be its own way of keeping the Sabbath holy? He liked that idea, I must say. Speaking of modes of transportation serving as a pathway to spiritual awakening, I do not know what it is about me and my 13-year-old car that can absolutely bring me to my knees, but there you have it. It's not the first time an episode with me and my little Prius has served as fodder for a sermon. Not long ago, I was at fault in a little fender bender. I clipped the rear bumper of this very expensive, gigantic SUV. I have also shared in the past that any kind of human mistake, any kind of carelessness on my part that costs real money to remedy causes me unrelenting self-reproach. The owner of the SUV was gracious enough to allow me to give her the $700 to fix the few scratches on her bumper without putting it through my insurance. Damage on my car was another story. Front bumper and the hood were pretty badly squashed, but it was all cosmetic damage. The car was perfectly drivable. I didn't even consider the possibility of getting it fixed. It's an old car. I certainly don't need to spend my money on that. And more to the point, I don't deserve it. But I have to say, in the days and weeks to follow, every time I went to get in or out of my car and was confronted with that damage, I suffered all over again, punishing myself. How could you have been so stupid? How could you have been so careless? I think my husband Scott grew a little weary of listening to me, and he finally said, "Why don't you just get a bid and see what you're talking about to get the damn car fixed?" So I went to a few body shops, feeling so ashamed and embarrassed to admit this was my fault and that's why I'm not putting it through insurance, as if they care. And the best bid I could find was $1,500. Well, forget it, I'm not spending that, out of the question. Around this same time, I was deeply honored. A dear friend called, asked me to officiate at his mother's funeral, be a small graveside service. Whenever I'm asked to officiate at a funeral or memorial service, I always feel as if I'm being bestowed with a sacred trust. And of course I am. And given that the work that I do, as you might imagine, I always see the higher perspective and hold the big picture. The first thought that crossed my mind was, what's everybody going to think at the cemetery when they see the minister get out of that beat-up old car? Around the same time, I had a new thought that came to me, which for me felt huge. What if I chose to get my car fixed, and instead of seeing it as a punishment, a penalty, a loss, what if I chose to see it as a spiritual exercise? What if I chose to see it as an opportunity to invest in my own peace of mind? What if I were to invest in grace to be a human being who can make a mistake? What if I were to invest in forgiveness? For me, this was huge. And so that's what I did. I picked up my car the day before the funeral, so glad to have it back. That morning, got up early to drive to the cemetery. It felt so nice to have my car all clean, refreshed, looking its best. Got to the cemetery a little early and actually caught myself glancing across the lawn and seeing my car parked over there, looking its best and feeling kind of good about that. In a cemetery, the place where one contemplates the eternal and what's truly important in life. The funeral was on a Wednesday morning, and I needed to get back to work. I stopped at a Pollo Loco to grab a quick lunch before heading back to UCLA, careful to park on the far side of the lot all by myself just to be on the safe side. I know you know what that's like. I come out of the restaurant after lunch and cannot believe my eyes. I see my car over there, the rear bumper completely smashed. Hit and run. Are you kidding me? I can't have my car nice for a day. I don't even have the Visa bill yet for the $1,500. And now look. So much for my little spiritual exercise. So much for investing in my own peace of mind. I went out of my mind. It was as if a dam had burst. Not knowing what else to do, I picked up the phone to call Scott, and I got his voicemail, and I ranted and wailed and screamed and cried into that phone. It must have been some kind of sight to see me running around that Pollo Loco parking lot in my suit, in my dress shoes, screaming and crying into my phone like a crazy man, as if I'd run over a child or something. I just can't accept this. I can't have my car nice for a day. Look at what I do for a living. For so little money, I help so many people. Is it too much to ask? And at the same moment, I'm also acutely aware this is an obscenely over-the-top response to something so inconsequential and insignificant, particularly given the work that I'm privileged to do. Every day I walk beside people dealing with real tragedy and real loss, and look at how I'm carrying on. But the thing is, a core wound had been ripped open, and the bleeding was unstoppable. And that wound is that place that lives within me, that lives within many of us, I believe, that clings so desperately to the idea that life should be just, the universe should be fair, and people should do the right thing, goddammit. And at this age, I find when those core wounds get ripped open, the best response I have is to simply stand in awe of the power of the wound and bear witness, rather than try to rationalize, reason why it is I should respond somehow differently than I do. You don't rationalize with a screaming baby. You pick up the baby, and you hold it, and you say, "There, there," until the wailing subsides. Several months earlier, one of the chemo infusion nurses referred me to Valerie on her first day of chemotherapy. Valerie, 36, a working mom, 9-year-old daughter, newly diagnosed with breast cancer. When I first met Valerie, she was quick to say, "Oh yeah, Michael, at first I really did struggle with why me, but now I've put all that behind me and I just want to focus on getting through treatment." The more she talked, the more it became abundantly clear, crystal clear in fact. As much as she would like to have believed that were true, it simply was not. She was very much struggling with why me. And the core of her spiritual distress was not so much her diagnosis as it was hearing the news that she could no longer bear any children. She and her husband had been desperately trying to get pregnant at the time of her diagnosis. She was also weary of trying to keep spiritual scorecards for herself. "I know, Michael, I should feel grateful, right? Look, I have one healthy child, I have a wonderful husband, I have a great job, I have insurance, I should be happy, right?" She was also very impatient with those in her world who wanted to keep that spiritual scorecard for her, on her behalf. "Valerie, look at it this way. Do you know how many couples can't have even one child? You should feel grateful and count your blessings." No one was simply allowing her to experience her grief and her loss to be a witness with compassion. I visited her regularly throughout her chemo infusions, and that devastation of injustice, the anger about it, never loosened its grip from around her throat. With the chemo now complete, next step in treatment was surgery. I went to see her in the hospital the day after her double mastectomy. First thing out of her mouth, "Michael, look at all those balloons everybody sent that say, 'Get well' on them, and look at all those pretty cards everybody sent me." "I'm sorry, Michael, I can't let it go. Those should have said, 'Congratulations, welcome to the new baby.'" My little Pollo Loco catastrophe had been a couple days earlier. I took a big risk in choosing to tell her about it, not remotely to commiserate or to compare our suffering, but to illustrate the power of a core wound once it's been ripped open, one that Valerie and I share, one that I believe many of us share, particularly as Americans, that we are hardwired to have this expectation that life be just and fair. I don't think all cultures have such an expectation. And when we're confronted with the devastation, the disappointment of that reality, fueled by all of those expectations, maybe we need to go a little easy on ourselves. So I would ask myself, can I come to a new relationship with the wound itself? Can I even come to a kind of peace with it? Can I learn to live in the tension between these two competing perceptions, these two competing realities? On one side that would say, it isn't fair, it's impersonal, it's random, shit happens. And on the other side, a perception that would say, sometimes it does seem like justice is served. Sometimes it seems like I get what I deserve. Sometimes it even seems like everything happens for a reason. More to the point, can I offer grace to the part of myself that still clings so desperately to my idea of justice and fairness? Just like the crazy man I was in that Poi Loko parking lot. Can I even have a grace that is generous enough, large enough to know that that part of myself might never let go? Maybe offering that grace to myself, to those wounds, to those expectations, might offer a pathway to peace with injustice. We'll just have to see. I'm working on it. So be it. Thank you.